OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernovsky. This show is for Parshat Beshalach. Recording and first broadcast of this show is Yom Chamishi, that's Thursday, the 10th day of Shavat, 5768, the 17th of January, 08. My offer still stands to listeners to email me if they want me to share a Mazel Tov with the audience, but I'm going to take advantage of it again. Yesterday morning, that would be Wednesday, the 16th of January, the 9th of Shvat, a grandson was born to us, my daughter Miri, two boys, a girl, and now another boy. The timing of the birth for Torah Tidbits purposes couldn't have been better. I had been up all night working on this week's issue. I finished about 5 in the morning. By 5:45, I was working in the print room on getting the first batch out. And my daughter called, asked me to come over and stay with the children so that she and her husband could go to the hospital. So the baby weighed in at 3 kilo 852 grams. I translated that for those people who need pounds and ounces to 8 pounds 7.5 ounces. And in more appropriate terms for us, the baby weighed in at 51.36 copies of Torah Tidbits this week. Mazel tov to the parents, to the brothers, to the sister, to the aunts and uncles and cousins, and to my mechutonim, the other grandparents. And we should see much nachas from this newborn, and he from all of us. I really don't mean to monopolize the Mazel tov department here, but again, my offer, TTA, Torah Tidbits Audio, I'll give you another address, TTA@OUIsrael.org. You can send me acknowledgement of a birth if you want it announced on the radio, a bar mitzvah, a bat mitzvah, an engagement, a wedding, an anniversary, or lahavdil between life and the other end of life, a yortzeit, that we could do some learning, maybe a Mishnah in memory of someone. We'll be glad to cooperate. Just send me an email to tta@ouisrael.org, and we'll take it from there. Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir ha-ma'alot mima'amakim kraticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, Tehiena aznecha kashuvot lekol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor ya Adonai mi ya'amod, ki imacha hasalicha lema'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzora uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem, viyotziyem mitzara lirvacha, umeafela leora umishibud legeula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, vinomar amen. Take a look at something which I think is quite unique for this week's parsha. The parsha's name is Beshalach. Vayhi Bishalach Paro et Ha'am, when Paro sent the people out of Egypt. It turns out very soon, by the way, that it was not Paro who sent them out. it was God who took us out, but that really develops in a very clear way when we read the events of the beginning. I'm already off on a tangent, but let's stay there for a moment. The important aspect, or an important aspect, of the Exodus, of Yetziat Mitzrayim, of the Jewish people getting out of Egypt, was that God took us out. And a different element, maybe even more important to us, is that we know without doubt that he took us out. It is always a kind of a situation where a paro, a king of a country, a dictator of a country, can claim by his magnanimous generosity that he released the people from their bondage. And this is something that needed to be very clear. It was God who took the people out of Egypt. Our structure of, I can't say the structure of Judaism, because I would hope that Judaism would survive even without, I don't even know if that's the right way to say it. An important starting point for who we are as a nation is that God took us out of Egypt. Therefore, it's a little strange that this parsha should say, Vayhi b'shalach paro et ha'am, that paro, when it came to pass, that paro sent the people out. But what unfolds later, which I'm sort of taking a little more time than I would want to get to, is that paro sent an army after the departing Jewish people to bring them back, and the events as recorded in Parshat B'Shalach that unfold are that it is obvious that he did not send the people out, and he does not have the ability to bring the people back, and the Egyptians were destroyed when the sea closed after it had split to allow the people of Israel crossage, is that a word? I don't know if you'll find it in a dictionary. I'll have to look later, but it's sort of the word that popped into my head. After the people crossed the sea on dry land, the waters closed on the Egyptians, grounding them, and then it became clear, if there was any doubt before, that it was not Paro who sent the people out, but it was God who took us out of Egypt. That's not what I'm driving at now. It's called Parshat B'Shalach, and the Shabbat on which we read Parshat B'Shalach has a name, Shabbat Shira, the Shabbat of the song. The song we're referring to is the Song of the Sea, which is in Parshat B'Shalach, but it is quite unusual for a Shabbat to be named by a portion of the weekly Torah reading. You've got Shabbat Bereshit, which is a Shabbat named after not just the book of Bereshit that we are starting, the book of Genesis, not just the Parsha called Bereshit, but it is Shabbat Bereshit because it represents, because of the Torah reading, it's the anniversary of the first Shabbat of creation. It really isn't, if we accept the notion that the world was created on Rosh Hashanah, and that Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei, corresponds to day six of creation, then the first Shabbat would be day two of Tishrei, which we don't look at as commemorative of the first Shabbat, but it's tied in with the Torah reading, and we call it Shabbat Bereshit. Shabbat Shuva is the, or Shabbat Teshuvah, the Shabbat between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. The name Shuva comes from the opening word of the Haftarah, the reading of the prophets for that week, but it talks about repentance. And Shabbat Chazon, the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av, the one on which we read Sedra Parshat Devarim, the Haftorah begins with Chazon Yeshayahu, and it became the name of that Shabbat. So it exists that there are Shabbatot that are named for Torah reading, prophets readings. Of course, you have the four special Shabbatot of Shkalim and Zachor and Parah and Hachodesh, but those are the Maftir that we read. What I find unique about Shabbat Shira is that the parsha is named for a portion within. The Shabbat is named for a portion within Parshat HaShavua, the weekly portion. But the significance of Uz Yashir Moshe, first let me describe briefly, in a Sefer Torah there are columns, somewhere around 245 columns in a whole Torah scroll, all of them of uniform width, except for the one that contains the Song of the Sea. That is an extra wide column, still having the same 42 lines in a standard Sefer Torah, but the text of the Song of the Sea is written in a very unique way, in brick fashion. There's alternating lines that have a couple of words, a space, a couple of words, a space, and a couple of words. In other words, two spaces on the line within the text, and the following line has a block of words, one space and a block of words. And if you repeat this, which is done in a Sefer Torah, it gives a brick-like appearance when you look at it. And there are Kabbalistic explanations as to what the blank space represents, but clearly it is also a way of singling this portion out. We're talking about the song of thanks and praise to God that the people sang after they successfully escaped Egypt completely. We can say that the actual leaving of Egypt was still a tenuous situation because, and what happened, Egypt pursued them. And it was not until their passage through the sea and the drowning of the Egyptians that the impact of having left Egypt finally is able to hit them. And that's when they burst out in song. Our tradition says that it was on the 7th of Pesach, 7th day of Pesach, which would put it the 21st day of Nisan, 1 week after actually leaving Egypt, that the Song of the Sea was sung. And that really is the culmination of the Exodus from Egypt. From that point on, you don't look back, you look forward now to what's going to happen. The song is unique in the Torah in being basically a quote of the Jewish people verbatim. God wrote the Torah. He dictated the Torah to Moshe. At this point, as if putting in one giant pair of quotation marks, or inverted commas as they say in England, the portion of Uz Yashir, because God was not dictating that from his own, he was dictating to Moshe the words that were sung by the people of Israel. And that's what makes it special, and that's what gives the Shabbat its name, Shabbat Shira, and that is what results in the fact that in many, many communities, in the Ashkenazi world at least, people stand for the reading of Uz Yashir, and even here, there's a certain uniqueness to it. When it comes to next week's Torah reading of Yitro, with the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments, there is a huge controversy as to whether it's appropriate to stand for the reading of the Ten Commandments or not. And it has to do with whether people overemphasize the significance of the Ten Commandments, and how do you put it back into its proper perspective of being part of the Torah by not singling it out for standing. Be that as it may, the interesting thing is I've never seen an argument or a discussion when it comes to Uz Yashir. People stand for Uz Yashir without controversy, without fear of saying this is a more important part of the Torah than other, because it isn't. It's part of the Torah. It's a special part, not more important, but special, because we sang it. And it's an eternal kind of song, hence the analysis of the opening words, Uz Yashir Moshe, then will Moshe and the people of Israel sing this song to God? And it talks not only about that time, but about the future as well. So it became a symbol. So much so that Uz Yashir is said in daily prayer. The end of Psukei Dezimra, the passages of praise to God, quoting usually or mostly from the book of Psalms, from Tehillim, culminate with this passage from the Torah. There's also another aspect of song on this Shabbat, and for this I need to take a step back and go in another direction and then tie it together. There is an old custom that on Shabbat Shira, or more properly on the Friday of Shabbat Shira, Erev Shabbat Shira, that people feed the birds. They leave out crumbs and bird seed for birds. It's the middle of the winter. It's sometimes difficult for birds to find sustenance on their own, and this is our gesture towards feeding the birds. Why specifically this week, and what is the connection to the Parsha? For this we go to another portion of Bishalach, which is known as Parshat Haman. Not Haman as the villain of the Purim story, but Haman as the man, the manna, which fell from heaven to feed the people on a daily basis throughout their wandering period in the wilderness. The Torah tells us that first the people complained that they were hungry, then God told Moshe what he planned to do about it, then Moshe told the people. Man fell one morning, the people went out to collect it, they were impressed by it, it tasted good, they didn't know what it was, they called it man, and they were instructed to eat whatever they needed to eat for that day, and not save any and leave it over for the next day, because it wouldn't be there. The Torah tells us that there were people who saved man. Now, when a slave mentality kind of person gets a quantity of food, his natural tendency is not to eat it all up, because he doesn't know where the next batch is coming from. So the tendency would be to save it. Here, they were told, notwithstanding that natural tendency, do not save over. Have trust, faith, confidence that there will be new man in the morning, which there was. And therefore, this was a sign of faith, and some people failed that test because they did leave over for the next morning. Then Moshe tells the people, on Friday, you eat what you want to for Friday, and you do save over for the following day, which is Shabbat. On Shabbat, the man will not fall, and the purpose of the double portion of man which falls on Friday is to allow you to prepare properly for Shabbat when going out into the fields and collecting the man or doing any other field work in later generations is not appropriate. Did I say not appropriate? I meant forbidden. In any event, the Torah says there were Jews who went out looking for man on Shabbat morning, and they didn't find it. The Midrash tells us that Datan and Aviram, two nemeses of Moshe Rabbeinu, spread man that they had collected on Friday around the camp with the intention of coming out Shabbat morning and making a liar out of Moshe. The Midrash says that in the very early morning, birds came and ate it up, thereby preserving the word of Moshe and the attention to it and of God, and a tradition developed, I don't know when it started, to thank the birds, specifically at this week when we read about the portion of the man, by feeding birds on Erev Shabbat Shira. This custom and practice of feeding birds for Shabbat Shira is a wonderful way to teach our children the lesson of Hakarat HaTov, acknowledging good that is done for you and not ignoring it. It starts with saying thank you, and there are a whole bunch of other ways to manifest this concept of Hakarat HaTov, but this is one that is, it's very nice for parents to take their children, get some bird seed, and set out food for the birds for this Shabbat and tell them the story. And it has a wonderful lesson value in it as well. And now we could tie the two things together by mentioning that specifically Shira, song, and the Hakarat HaTov that we showed to the birds, in addition to the birds having eaten up the mun to keep Moshe's word the way it was, we also acknowledge the birds for their gift to us, or put it a different way, for our borrowing from them the concept of song. Human beings speak. That's our special quality. Birds sing. Of course, human beings do also, but we can look at it in this fanciful way of borrowing the specialty, the special way birds sing praise to the Creator, and using their song, or their concept of song, for our Oz Yashir Moshe, and therefore we thank them for it by giving them some royalties, namely food to eat on these winter Fridays, especially before Shabbat Shira. It then becomes a double lesson in Hakarat HaTov. One way or the other, take a bird to lunch. And, of course, I should add that one should not restrict feeding the birds only to Shabbat Shira. It is good and a nice thing to put out food for them throughout this period of the year at least, and an extra special idea to do it with children or grandchildren, because you teach them a certain value of our position as human beings in the whole realm of nature, and a responsibility that we have or should have towards other creatures who share this world with us. To change the subject abruptly, I was listening to an old radio show, and I found this commercial by the American Cancer Society that you might find entertaining.
Josephine, open up! It's me, Napoleon Bonaparte, Emperor of all France, much of the civilized world, and Louisiana if the deal falls through.
Quick, Pierre, hide in the closet. Napoleon must not find you here.
Come in now, Pete!
Ah, Josephine, I had to see you.
Napoleon, my dearest heart, what are you doing here? I thought you were at Waterloo.
I was, but it ended early. What is that? I smell cigarette smoke. You know I hate you to smoke.
I didn't. I don't. I started again.
Aha! The smoke coming from that closet. Come out of there, you scoundrel, and on guard!
It was only in there to pick up the dry cleaning.
Take that, you filthy escargot!
This world history lesson was brought to you by your American Cancer Society, which says smoking can be injurious to your health.
Touché!
In more ways than one,
we'll return to our
show
in a moment.
You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Shabbat Parshat Beshalach, Shabbat Shira. Speaking of Shira,
ולעזבונו אומר, אומר שתסתכל.
The choice of that song was sort of a train of thought. I spent some time in the first part of the show talking about birds. I'm going to speak a little bit about the upcoming Tu B'Shvat, and even if I don't speak about it, it's coming up, whether we speak about it or not, this coming Tuesday. And that's a very nature-oriented date. Birds are from nature, feeding the birds, and the reality of wildlife. And another aspect of Judaism, which also brings us outdoors, is Kiddush Levana, the bracha which we say to God in the presence of a moon, somewhere between the third or the seventh day, different opinions, from the molad, from the new moon moment. 3 days after that, or 7 days after that, we can start saying Kiddush Levana until the moon reaches its fullness at a point in Hebrew called the Nigud, which is opposition, where the moon is full. And part of that song was from the text, which we say as part of Kiddush Levana. So right now is a prime time to say Kiddush Levana. We had first opportunity, according to the three-day custom, last Motzoi Shabbat, last Saturday night, the 12th of January, and according to the seven-day custom, Tuesday night, two nights ago, was their first opportunity. So right now we have the prime time to be saying it. People will probably be saying it this Motzoi Shabbat, and you could say it until Tuesday night coming up. And that's why the song is there. While I was recording, I hear a knock at my door. There's a little sign hanging out saying that I'm recording this Torah Tidbits audio, so please enter quietly. Person didn't see the sign until after he knocked. And he came in, and it was very nice to see him, an old friend of mine. We go back to elementary school days, and we've kept up all of these years. Rabbi Shaya Klimnik from Rochester, New York, a frequent visitor to Israel. And I asked him for a quick Dvar Torah for Parshat B'Shalach. Not everybody is capable of giving a Dvar Torah at the drop of a hat, so to speak, but he is one of the people that can do it, and I'd like to share with you his words.
In the Sefer B'Shalach, we see that Moses informs the Jewish people as Paro is in pursuit of them, and here they're standing by the banks of the river or the sea, and Moses says, Shem Yilachem Lachem V'Atem Tacharishim, God will fight for you. You be silent. And yet we see at the end of the Sedge, it is Yeshua who has to lead our Jewish people into battle, while Moshe Rabbeinu has to ascend on top of a mountain and raise his hands. Why is it that that is over there, that God does not intervene in behalf of our Jewish people in that confrontation? So I once heard from a wonderful rabbi, Rabbi Heschel Schechter, the father of Rabbi J.J. Schechter. It's because at the very beginning, it is Egypt that is in pursuit of our Jewish people, which presents a physical threat to our survival. Whenever there is a physical threat to our survival, indeed we're supposed to fight. Indeed, we are not permitted to depend on miracles. But ultimately, it's God who protects us and God who allows for our physical existence and survival. But the war of Amalek is a different war. It's a war that requires us to battle spiritually. It's a war against a foe that threatens us spiritually. There we have to take up arms. There we have to confront them. There God says, I'm not going to fight that battle. You must battle for yourselves. Hashem Yilachem Lachem, God will fight our battles. We will always survive physically. But the spiritual battles are the ones that we have to encounter and assume all responsibilities for.
Rabbi Shaya Klimnik visiting from Rochester, New York. An interesting idea that he presents at the very end of Parshat B'Shalach. We have Vayavo Amalek. Amalek comes and attacks the Jewish people. And of course that attack was primarily a physical attack, but the Milchama L'Amalek Midor Dor, the perpetual generation after generation battle against Amalek, is a battle of spiritual values as well as physical survival. And therefore, Rabbi Klimnik, quoting Rabbi Schechter's idea, is well taken. Pure physical survival of the Jewish people, we have to have our own hishtadlus, our own effort at bringing that about and keeping that there. God will help in a great way. Spiritual survival is, I guess, as Rabbi Klimnik put it, our responsibility, because this is the arrangement we made with God. God said, "Va'atem tihyu li mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh," you will be a holy nation unto me, I will be your God, I will give you the Torah and the command to follow it. And therefore the survival is already built in as a condition towards keeping the Torah and following God. And to a greater extent, it is our efforts that are necessary, with God's help, of course, to maintain and to advance and increase our spiritual well-being. On another note, we, of course, have been introduced to Shabbat from the account of creation in the beginning of Bereshit. But the first introduction of the Jewish people to Shabbat in a Jewish perspective is the episode of the Mun, which is interesting and probably the butt of some gags about the Jews' love of food, and that holidays are marked with food, and certainly Shabbat is as well. But it's a significant idea that we take, or we are given, a physical basic need like food, and it becomes spiritualized, always staying food. And in many different areas of Jewish life, we see that that's the approach. Not to say your physical life is one thing and your spiritual development is something else. Your spiritual development comes from sometimes very mundane things like food. And the fact that we are constantly in a process of raising the idea of food above its mundane physical level in all sorts of ways. The fact that no food enters our mouths without a bracha, that we acknowledge God for the food with a bracha acharona as well, that we have rules of kashrut, the whole complex laws of kashrut, what animals we could eat and what we can't eat, how to prepare an animal to eat, various rules and regulations in the land of Israel regarding agricultural products, the separation of milk and meat, all of these combine to say not that we should be left alone and let me eat what I want to eat and I'll be spiritual during periods of meditation. No. The spirituality comes from the moment we wake up in the morning until the moment we go to sleep. Part of that day is spent eating, and eating therefore becomes a tool with which to become a spiritual person, as funny as that might seem, because food is associated with physicality. And the fact that we were first introduced to the idea of Shabbat, that on Shabbat, different from the rest of the week, the mun will not fall, and it will not be our task to go out and collect our needs for the day, but that Shabbat is a day to be prepared for. I'm going to drift now into another aspect of it, but it says the same thing. The laws on Shabbat of cooking, the prohibition of cooking, are very complex and detailed. Just to give you a little glimpse into one area, you have a pot of food being kept warm on the stove. It's been cooked on Friday, and it remains hot over a covered fire on the stove. You want much of it for lunch the next day. Let's say we're talking about your chont, which is your beef, bean, potato, etc., etc., stew, which simmers the whole night. But Friday night, you would like to have some. So you have a large pot, and you're going to serve some of the chont, ready to eat and ready to cook, ready to enjoy, rather, and it's not yet that extra quality of having simmered overnight, but it's still delicious and you want some on Friday night. In order to get it, You have to remove the pot from the stove with intention of returning it to its place of keeping hot. Not let go of it, preferably not even to put it down. To serve from it into serving bowls, and then to return it to the fire, to the covered fire. It has to be a covered fire. It has to have intention of being returned. It could not yet have cooled down. It still has to be pretty much hot, and preferably to hold on to it and not even to put it down. All of these conditions, in order to be allowed to take from a pot on the stove and then put the food back onto the stove in order to have it hot for Shabbat day. This was one example of a very complicated area of Hilchot Shabbat, of the laws of Shabbat, and how to avoid violation of cooking, which is a very serious prohibition on Shabbat. Wait, I have a better idea. No hot food on Shabbat. Cold salads, whatever you prepare on Friday, you serve at cold or at room temperature, and nobody will run the risk of doing the wrong thing with the stove. Our sages said, not acceptable. Shabbat is a day to be honored. It is a day to enjoy. Part of honoring it and enjoying it is having delicious meals, not the least of your meals of the week, but the best of your meals of the week. That's how the Torah wants us to honor Shabbat, and perhaps proof of which is our first introduction to Shabbat being in this week's reading, Parshat Haman. And therefore, we are going to complicate your lives, say our sages, by requiring you to jump hoops, or the expression in Hebrew, turn cartwheels in the air, in order to be able to have warm food, delicious meals, without one possible violation of Shabbat. This is the challenge of Shabbat observance. Again, it is not sitting for a period of time and meditating on God's creation of the world and his resting after 6 days of creation, and you sit there and you hum and you meditate, and then you go and you have a meal. The meal of Shabbat is not a break from one's experience of Shabbat and one's enjoyment of Shabbat and one's spiritual enjoyment of Shabbat. It is part of it. I think I've said it enough different ways, and I hope the point has gotten across. We do not believe in asceticism of bread and water and depriving oneself of good food, because we feel that would be a deprivation of a way to serve God properly. There's a statement in the Talmud someplace, one rabbi said, he who resists enjoying a food, he sees a new fruit and says, better not eat that because that would be too much catering to my physical side, is totally wrong. I'm not doing justice to that piece of Talmud, but that's the idea of it. We are supposed to enjoy food. We're not supposed to eat in excess. We're not supposed to eat unhealthy. That's also part of our task. Again, drifting a little within the same topic, I remember being astonished that Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, in addition to all of the above things that I mentioned within the laws of kashrut or making brachot, and things that we would readily see as religious, there are things written in Shulchan Aruch which sound like manners, etiquette, and yet there's an idea behind them as well. The fact that Shulchan Aruch says you're not allowed to talk while you eat. I used to think that mothers say that to their children, but it is a halakha. There is a medical reason behind it. It has to do with choking on your food because of improper closure by the epiglottis of the trachea during a swallow. But it's part of halacha. That when two people are sitting and sharing a common plate, let's say of hummus, and one is talking to the other, the one who's listening should stop eating. Not eat while that person is talking. It's a courtesy. There's also a practical side to it. But it all goes to the statement that I am trying to say, that our food is part of our religion, all jokes aside. So now we have birds and the moon and food. Let's talk a little bit about Tu Bishvat. Tu Bishvat Higia Chag La'ilanot. It's a festival of the trees. It's not really that. The Mishnah tells us that there are four Rosh Hashanahs. The Rosh Hashanah that we call Rosh Hashanah has a certain function, the first day of Nisan, the first day of Elul perhaps, or Tishrei as well, and the 15th of Shavat, which is, according to the opinion of Hillel, the opinion that we follow, the middle of the winter season. The winter season is called Tekufat Tevet. It includes the months of Tevet, Shavat, and Adar. Midway through Shavat is the midpoint there, and that becomes a demarcation line between what fruits are considered to be last year's fruits and what fruits are considered to be the coming year's fruits, and there are various agricultural halachic issues that depend on that distinction. But the fact is that Tu Bishvat has become a nature awareness time. There is an emphasis on eating different fruits. There are some people who eat 15 different kind of fruits at their Tu Bishvat Seder-like meal, where they took the number 15 from the fact that it's the 15th of Shvat, and other people have 100 fruits, which is kind of stretching it, but you include all kind of different nuts as different fruits, and dried fruit as well as fresh fruit, and all kind of varieties, and you see that there are a lot of them. I think part of what Tu Bishvat is and what it became is a statement in the Torah, Ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh. A person is like the tree of the field. We identify with nature and therefore we celebrate in a certain way that shows our value that we put into nature. Ecologists look at Tu Bishvat as their holiday. Tree planting, of course, this year is problematic in Israel because of Shemitah. I read in the paper earlier that Keren Kayemet Li'Israel, which is a non-religious, it's not, it's just secular organization of forestry in Israel and all other kind of things like that, announced that they're not going to do any planting of trees during Shemitah, which means that Shemitah is being observed in our time. Leaving all of the other discussions aside, it's an interesting point, at least to end this show on. We are very quickly running out of time, just enough to wish you a Shabbat Shalom. Take a bird to lunch on Friday. Tu Bishvat Sameach. Hug a tree next Tuesday. More importantly, value all that God has given us in this world. Appreciate Him for all that we have. And let's do our share to make this a better world. Lehishtamea.